13.
Online.
The corporation technician whispered. On board the Oregon, a radio operator adjusted his receiver. The sound of a maid came through his headset. He flipped a switch to a recorder, then keyed his microphone.
Okay, he said. We're recording.
Climbing down from the tree, the technician gathered up the limbs he had trimmed, then spent the next few hours working on the bushes. When he had finished the job and loaded the rented truck with the debris, it was just past lunchtime. Walking around to the service entrance, he handed a bill to the manager of the mansion. Then he walked back to the truck and drove away. Back on the Oregon, the radio operator monitored the conversation in the mansion and made notes on a yellow pad. Nothing much was happening, but that might change at any moment. Below decks, in the magic shop, the band was rehearsing. Kevin Nixon motioned for them to stop, then adjusted the control panel.
All right, he said. From the top, again.
Murphy started strumming his guitar, and the opening bars of the Creedence Clearwater Revival song Fortunate Son filled the shop. The rest of the band added their parts. Halpert's voice was surprisingly good. After being washed through the computer, it was hard to tell his rendition from the original. His moves were good as well, unlike those of most of the band. Cabrillo on the keyboards came off as Liberace on methamphetamines. Kasim moved like Buddy Rich in a neck brace. Lincoln was slightly better. He kept his eyes closed and strummed the bass guitar and managed to tap his foot in time. The problem was that his hands were so large it looked like he was not moving his fingers. Nixon waited until the song was finished.
It's not bad, he admitted, but I have some videotapes of live bands, and I suggest you men watch them so you can work on your choreography.
3 hours later, the band was as ready as they would ever be. This was the part of her job Iselda loved best, the last-minute nagging details. She reached in her handbag and found a pack of thin brown cheroots. Unlike most smokers who stuck to a single brand, Iselda stocked her bag with 3 or 4 different kinds. She selected her poison depending on many factors: the aching in her lungs, the rawness of her throat, the amount of nicotine needed for the job, menthols for that minty, fresh buzz, thin cigars when she needed a boost, long, thin, brightly tipped tools when she needed to punctuate a conversation by using the burning sticks like a maestro's baton. She fired up the cheroot and took a drag.
"I specifically requested glacier ice for the cocktails," she screamed at the caterer. "Not the round highball cubes!"
"You asked for both," the caterer said, "but the glacier ice has yet to arrive."
"You'll have it here?"
she asked.
"It's in the warehouse, Iselda," the man said patiently. "We didn't want it to melt."
Iselda stared across the tent to where a worker was adjusting the devices that made clouds of smoke from dry ice.
"We need more smoke than that,"
she shouted, then quickly walked across to the row of machines and began to berate the worker. After a few minutes of adjustment, the man flipped the machine on again. Clouds of dense, cold gas billowed from the machine, then began to settle on the floor.
"Good, good," Iselda said.
"Now make sure we have plenty of dry ice."
A technician was adjusting the light display, and she raced in that direction. On board the Oregon, the technician monitoring conversations in the mansion made a note on the yellow pad, then reached for the shipboard communication microphone.
"Chairman Cabrillo," he said, "I think you need to come up here."
The limousine slowed outside the gate leading to the runway at the San Jose, California airport. A guard with a holstered weapon stood blocking the way. The driver rolled down his window.
"New security regulations," he said. "There's no more driving out of the tarmac."
The software billionaire had rolled down his window as well. This was an unwelcome inconvenience. Intolerable, in fact.
"Wait a minute now," he shouted from the rear. "We've driven out to my plane for years."
"Not anymore," the guard noted.
"Do you know who I am?"
the billionaire said pompously.
"No idea," the guard admitted. "But I do know who I am. I'm the guy that's ordering you to turn away from the gate now."
With nothing else to say, the limousine driver backed up and steered toward the terminal. then parked in front and waited for his employer to climb out. The encounter put his boss in a foul mood, and he could hear him muttering as he carried the bags a safe distance behind.
"Good God," the billionaire said. "For what I pay for hangar space, you'd think I'd get some service!"
As they approached the door leading out to the taxiway, a smattering of expensive jets sat awaiting their owners. There were a trio of Gulfstreams, a Citation or two, a half dozen King Airs, and a single burgundy behemoth that looked like it belonged to a regional airline. The software billionaire was big on appearances. If the rich had private jets, he wanted a large one, an airplane that screamed success and excess like a dog collar made from diamonds. The billionaire's choice was a Boeing 737. The aircraft was fitted with a single-lane bowling alley, a hot tub, and a bedroom bigger than many homes. It was fitted with a large-screen television, advanced communications equipment, and a chef trained at the Cordon Bleu. The pair of dancers he had ordered from the service were already aboard. The entertainment for his flight was a California blonde and a redhead who bore a striking resemblance to a young Anne Margaret. The billionaire wanted some way to pass the time on the long flight. He burst through the door leading outside without waiting for his driver with the luggage, then made his way over to the 737. Then he walked up the ramp and inside.
"Ladies!" he shouted. "Front and center!"
13 minutes later, they were airborne. Inside the Oregon, the technician was entering commands in the computer when Caprio opened the door and walked inside. "What have you got?" he said, without preamble. "Ho just had a telephone conversation with an insurance adjuster who's coming out to the mansion to inspect the Buddha."
"Damn," Cabrillo said, reaching for the microphone.
"Max, you better get up to communications. We've got a problem." While the technician continued to trace the source of the call, Cabrillo paced the control room. Hanley arrived a few minutes later.
"What is it, Juan?"
"Ho has an insurance adjuster coming out to inspect the Golden Buddha."
"When?"
Hanley asked. 4 p.m. The technician hit a button and a printer spit out a sheet.
"Here's the location of the call, boss," he said. "I have it overlaid on a map of Macau."
"We need to come up with a plan," Cabrillo said. "Post haste." Winston Spencer was juggling chainsaws. Only his long stint as a customer of the bank had earned him an increase on his business line of credit, but the manager had made it clear he wanted the balance paid down in no less than 72 hours. His credit cards were at their limits, and calls had already come into his office in London inquiring about the situation. For all intents and purposes, Spencer was, at this instant, in dire financial straits. As soon as the deal with the billionaire went down, he would be as flush as he had ever dreamed. Right now, however, he could not afford an airplane ticket home. All he had to do tomorrow was remove the Buddha, transfer it to the airport, and receive his ill-gotten gain. Then he'd charter a jet and fly off into the sunset with his fortune. By the time his customer in Macau realized he'd been duped, he'd be long gone.